This podcast is brought to you by Soapbox. Start your own podcast today at www.soapbox.host.
Welcome back to Wednesday at 9 p.m. Season 2, Episode 10. On tonight's show, we discuss Bob the Arsonist, warding off ghosts the old-fashioned way, and how to snag a hot fairy bride. My name is Nick, and joining me are Aaron and Frank, as always.
Nick, I'm excited. I'd like to quick say I'm going to refer this episode to Cameron, so he has some chance finding a hot fairy bride. I think that'd do him a lot of good.
Nick, I have just a statement.
Yeah.
The way that you started that intro, you always manage to take the intros and make it so that I don't know. And I haven't, for those of you at home, I haven't looked at Nick's notes, so I have no idea what the topic is tonight. So I still have no idea what the topic is tonight, but I'm thoroughly intrigued.
I really make an effort to try to make the hooks as outlandish, but still relevant as possible.
And the rest of your episodes, you do that as well.
Well, yeah.
It's a skill.
Yeah, if anyone needs help writing hooks for podcasts, let me know.
Email. Or if you need help hosting podcasts,
use soapbox.host.
At the start of this episode, they're going to have a little advertisement. Double the advertisement.
double ad space that we are paying for.
Yeah, we got to pay ourselves $5 for that.
But anyway, shout outs as usual. Shout out to my mother. And now that, well, I still need to talk to Frank about getting the YouTube stuff figured out, but eventually we'll get my dad listening too.
Yes, it's in progress of being uploaded to YouTube, though I'll say the YouTube podcast support is terrible, but it kind of exists. So you will be able to listen through there, though it will be probably a static image, not a very enticing video.
It's just something to put on in the background. And of course, shout out to David Hoy. You guys have anything?
Wherever he is.
Sure. I've got a few shout outs. Shout out to Fallon, as always. You know, the classic shout out to Troy from Nick. Nick, you missed that one. I don't know how you didn't get it.
Oh, my bad.
Yeah, I think that's it from me. Frank?
Shout out to Sarah and Makana, who is a friend of ours that has been listening through our archive, is up to episode 5. And maybe one day we'll have her on the show. She's a fan of the spooky podcast genre and has come to enjoy our show somehow.
Yay. Yeah, I was going to say, ooh, those early episodes. Woof.
Yes.
Especially episode 1.
We'll see if she makes it to episode, I think this 36. Is number 36.
Yes, and it's season 2, episode 10, for those of you keeping track, as I said in the opening.
Now listed in Apple Podcasts, actually. So.
Oh, nice.
That's all for me.
Well, without further ado, we are going to get into some good stories that I found. So
wonderful.
I initially was going to do a story or research a topic that our other friend of the show, Chris, my friend growing up, he gave me a topic to look into, and I was going to do that one, but then when I looked into it, all I could find were like TikTok videos about it and no like books or articles or anything. So I'm just like, I don't know where they're getting the information from. I didn't click on any of the videos because I don't want to give those people the time of day. But then, so we had to do an Audible and we changed up we changed up what we were doing, and I decided to go down the road of looking at some books from the one and only Rosemary Ellen Guiley. God rest her soul.
A titan of the industry.
Yes. She did pass away several years ago, but she is very well known in the paranormal research world. Specifically with gin. That is not what this episode is about, though. I was thinking about it, but decided not to. Instead, I bought her book, The Encyclopedia of Ghosts and Spirits.
Now, that's a coffee table book if I've ever heard one.
And it will be linked in the show notes, the Amazon link. And it's just a collection of stories, certain types of ghosts, and also like famous people and researchers, mediums, parapsychologists, and kind of goes through like brief histories of those people as well. And it's all alphabetical. So it like starts,
that's cool.
If there's an AA thing, it starts there and goes all the way down to like zombie, like the Haitian.
So it's really like
zombie.
A reference that you can kind of pick up. Yeah. And
yeah,
that's cool.
But there were some really good stories in here. So I was like, all right, this was a good choice. It's very similar to like the yokai episode we did, where it was just kind of an encyclopedia, just going through, oh, these are the different sorts of yokai that exist in these different mediums. So,
and that's for those interested, that was episode, I'll cut the pause here,
27, I believe. It started off season 2, I think that was our season opener.
That is correct. Yeah.
So if you want a similar structured episode, go check that one out for sure.
If you haven't already.
If you haven't already, yes. You get to hear me try to pronounce a lot of Japanese names. But anywho, I'd like to start off with a pretty big story. There was a lot going on for this story. In it, it's referred to as the Amherst Haunting. And now it's not Amherst in Massachusetts, nor is it Amherst out in Western New York, but it is in Amherst, Nova Scotia, in the late 19th century.
Interesting.
So, you know, well over 100 years old, 150 years old almost here. And we're looking at the Teed family in 1878. There's Daniel, who is the father, Olive, the mother or matriarch. They have two young sons, which I don't know. I don't actually think their names were ever mentioned.
Lost to time.
Yeah. Then there are Olive's sisters, Jenny and Esther. Who Jenny's 22, Esther's 19, so they're young women. William, who's Olive's brother, and John, who is Daniel's brother. So they all live together. But, you know, it's the 1800s. That's pretty normal. Like living with a big family. And so they're in a two-story cottage up in Nova Scotia. And the activity in this haunting starts out one night when she jumps out of the bed that she's sharing with Jenny and is screaming that there's a mouse in the bed. And she's just freaking out. They look in the bed, look around the room. There's nothing. There's no mouse. They don't see anything. So they end up falling back asleep. However, the next night, they hear rustling noises in a bandbox. And I had to look up what that was. It's essentially a circular cardboard box that you put hats in. And
interesting.
So when they examined the band box, they found nothing in the box. So they heard this rustling noise in it, but they didn't. There was nothing in it. There was nothing in the box.
Not even hats?
Not even hats. The story also said that the box was rising and falling in the air. I don't know if that means it was like levitating or the rustling made it sound like it was rising and falling.
Just like an invisible ghost is just like holding it.
Yeah.
Moving it up and down. And all these
it's just like
moving.
Checking it out. It's like lifting it up. It's like, what is this? Yeah. So it didn't say it was explicitly levitating, but that's just something I didn't know what that meant, but I was like, maybe it meant it was levitating. I don't know. And now the next night, Esther goes to bed feeling sick. You know, maybe stomach, whatever. She's not feeling well. But abruptly gets out of bed and claims that she's dying.
Oh, okay.
Her her family members rush into her room and they see Esther's short hair standing on end. Her face is blood red and her eyes were, quote, popping.
What?
I don't know if that meant like the blood vessels were popping and her eyes were red, or if it was like they were bulging.
Graves' disease, sort of bulging.
Yeah, I don't know.
It sounds like a CGI scene from a horror movie.
Yeah, or like
Bilbo in Lord of the Rings when he when he grabs the ring.
Yeah, in Rivendell.
Yeah.
Don't worry, because it gets crazier. Two of her family members say that she's mad. Like, you know, she's insane, something's going on, she's crazy. But that accusation ended up turning into like awe, but in like the fear way, as they see Esther's body swell to double its size. So it's like we're in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory.
I was just going to say that, Nick.
So
except she's not turning violet. She's turning blood red.
And her cries of pain are coupled with thunderous booms, but there's no clouds outside in the sky.
What is going on?
I know. It's crazy. The swelling eventually subsides, so probably wasn't really double, but, you know, whatever. It eventually subsides, but 4 nights later, Esther and Jenny were sleeping in their bed, and their bedclothes, which are just sheets, just like the sheets on your bed, were torn away from them and thrown into a pile in the corner of the room.
That's classic poltergeist stuff.
Oh, yeah. The two of them screamed, obviously. I would, too, probably. Unless it was just Frank, which could happen.
That's true. Then I would scream. I'd be screaming at you as I...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But as they screamed after this happened, the rest of the family again rushes into the room. Esther is really swollen again. And so were these thunderous booms. And they're just like, what is happening?
Were the booms coming from her?
It's not
specified.
We'll get into what some people may have thought.
And it's just Esther, not
Jenny.
Jenny.
Yes, it is just Esther.
Interesting.
And remember, Esther is 19 and Jenny's 22. So Esther's the younger one, but she's, you know, it's not like she's an adolescent.
Yeah.
Right, but my point, or what I was trying to get at, is they were in the same bed.
Correct.
When the sheets got torn off. So it's not just like Esther going crazy.
Correct.
Okay.
So Jenny then goes and replaces the sheets, but after she does that, a pillow flies off the bed and hits John, who is Daniel's brother, in the face. He flees the room, and the rest of the family tried to just sit on the bed to hold the sheets down so Esther can fall back asleep. The next day, they call a local physician, Dr. It's either like Carrite or Carrot, C-A-R-R-I-T-T-E. I'm going to say Carrite. Just to kind of check on Esther, because they're really confused. They have no idea what's going on. However, while the good doctor was examining Esther, the bolster, like, of her bed.
What is that?
Like the headboard?
Yeah. It rose up and violently hit him in the head.
Oh my God.
And then went back to where it was. He's like dazed and trying to get his bearings, but eventually he does. And then he hears a metallic scratching sound coming from the wall behind him. Now, Frank, I know what you might be thinking. No, it's not our furry friend. But he turns around and he sees written on the wall, Esther Cox, you are mine to kill.
What a nice message. Now it's starting to sound demonic.
Oh, yeah.
That wasn't her last name, was it?
She was Olive's, or she, I guess, was. She's passed away, hopefully, by now. That'd be crazy if not. she was Olive's sister who was married to Daniel. Esther was not. She's just her sister, so she still has their maiden name, probably.
Gotcha. Yeah. Understood.
As Dr. Cartwright sees the words, he heard thunder and saw pieces of plaster fall from the ceiling and start circling around the room.
What the hell is going on here?
I don't know. You tell me.
Adolescent girl.
She's 19. She's not adolescent.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's a little after it. Yeah. I mean, it's still a classic that young women seem to have poltergeist activity attracted to them.
I know, but
them.
It's typically going like through 16. Puberty.
Yeah.
Not so much when they're 19. So that does get said later on about like, what could have happened? But she doesn't fit the bill.
I'm calling demon.
Anyway. Dr. Cartwright, bless his soul, returned the next day. He came back. And as he was bending over to examine Esther again, he was hit with a volley of potatoes that sent him flying across the room.
In her bedroom?
No, I think this was... actually, yes. Yes. Yes, it was.
Where did the potatoes come from?
I have no idea.
You don't keep potatoes in your room?
No.
I usually like a midnight
finish
snack?
Them before bed. No, I finish them before bed.
That's makes sense. Makes sense.
Eating raw potatoes is a sign of a healthy jaw.
Is that what the physician said?
Yeah, that's what Dr. Cartwright said. So that's strange. Like, yeah, where are the potatoes coming from? It's like some Bell Witch activity.
Yeah.
But the next day, Esther complained of feeling like electricity was going through her body. And they know what electricity is at this point. Like, it's...
yeah.
It's relatively, like, known and commercialized at this point. So, Dr. Cartwright gives her sedatives to just put her to sleep. And as he's doing that, he hears a loud rapping sound. Again, very classic poltergeist sounds. And he goes outside to investigate and uses the moonlight to try to look around outside. And he looks up on the roof and there's nothing on the roof either. So, and it sounded like it was coming from there. So he's like, okay, there's nothing here. And then when he gets back inside, the family said what they heard, the family said they had heard what sounded like someone hitting their roof with a sledgehammer while the doctor was outside.
And it's not like he didn't hear it.
No, he didn't hear it. And it's not like he was going to be able to climb up on the roof, bang with a sledgehammer, and come back down. So these poundings continued kind of here and there, but still they continued throughout the day and even were heard by people walking by the house.
That's rare. Wow.
So the noises ended up getting reported in the local Gazette newspaper and were reported in other papers throughout Canada. So this is starting to turn into, it's getting to the, you know, sensationalized point almost that these noises are being heard and it's getting reported in the local papers.
This story is sounding very familiar to me now.
I don't know if it's based off it, if anything is based off it. So I don't know.
Interesting.
About 3 weeks after Dr. Cartwright's initial visit, for some reason, the family starts to converse with whatever this entity is.
That's a mistake.
I don't know why they did that.
Bad idea.
So the neighborhood, everyone is hearing about what's happening. And the clergy ends up being involved. And now, Frank, this is something we can talk about at the end about what you think. But the clergy being skeptical, like they typically are at the beginning of things like this.
That's good.
They had said that the newly commercialized electricity was to blame for the behavior and activity rather than anything supernatural or demonic. And then a Baptist clergyman, a Reverend Dr. Edwin Clay, started to visit the home regularly. And the Reverend believed that Esther's nerves had received some sort of electric shock, turning her into essentially a living battery. And he thought that her body was emitting tiny flashes of lightning. And so those thunderous noises were actually coming from her.
From what?
The flashes of lightning.
I'm curious what Aaron thinks about this battery.
Well, we'll finish the story. We'll finish the story completely before we talk about things. But keep that in mind, that this is a theory that the Reverend puts out. And he begins giving lectures on the theory I just stated, and is defending Esther against any accusations of fraud. He's saying that she is not faking any of what's happening. And as the story got bigger, people started to gather outside the house, which is pretty common.
Yeah.
And crazy to hear that it even happened almost 150 years ago.
No peace for the family.
Nope. However, Esther came down with diphtheria months later, but she did recover. But in the meantime, she moved away to stay with another sister in New Brunswick. And while she was gone, the cottage had some peace and quiet. So there was no activity while she was gone. But then when she returned home, guess who showed up again? The spirit. And one night, Esther told Jenny she was hearing a voice say it was going to burn down the house. And it also said it had lived on Earth once, died, and became a ghost. The girls call in the rest of the family to relay what Esther had allegedly been hearing. And they were all kind of laughing at the idea, thinking it's crazy. That can't happen. And then lit matches began falling from the ceiling onto Esther's bed.
Oh my goodness.
They started talking to the spirit again. And when asked if it would actually burn down the house, it answered yes. And maybe as a sign that it was serious and it was going to keep that promise, one of Esther's dresses that was hanging on the wall was rolled up as if someone invisible just rolled up the dress, stuffed it underneath the bed, and set it ablaze. Luckily, Daniel stomped it out before any serious damage was done to the house. The spirit became known as Bob. That's what they called that. Him? It? They? We? Who knows? But then Bob set Olive's skirts on fire and apparently set other small fires in various parts of the house. One fire started from a bucket of cedar shavings in the basement. And Esther saw that and ran out of the basement screaming for help. And her neighbors ended up coming to aid in the fire, putting it out. And the local fire department thought it was arson. And they thought Esther did it. And she lit this fire in the basement. However, according to the story, Olive had Esther in some sort of view when the fire had started. So she could not have been responsible for what had happened. The public went so far to suggest Esther be flogged to beat the evil out of her. But instead, Daniel sent her to a Mr. White for her own safety. But even in her absence, the fires continued to be set at home. Eventually, an actor named Walter Hubble became interested in the story. And he tried to make some money out of it. So you kind of, that also, it even happened back then.
So industrious.
Oh, yeah. And the way he did this was by putting Esther basically on exhibition and try to get the spirit to cause some mayhem. However, nothing would happen for any of these times, and the two were booed off stage and the crowd demanded refunds.
That is so funny. I mean, this, you know, the spirit being like, no, I am not performing for you when you want me to.
Give him a refund.
Yeah, right.
So this is while Esther is gone. She eventually returns back to the Teed home with the actor, Walter Hubble, because he wanted to learn more. He wanted to see what everything was about. And he certainly would learn a lot when he was assaulted by his umbrella, a carving knife, and a huge armchair that came marching across the room toward him. I like to picture it as it stood up and ran at him, because it's just a funny image.
Like back and forth, like on like the sides. Like
it's like, if you've ever watched the Peanuts Thanksgiving where Snoopy fights the lawn chair, think of it like that.
And link in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll put a clip. Copyright pending.
Yeah.
So this actor got his fill. And then another reverend, the Reverend R.A. Temple, wanted to put an end to this. It did not say his denomination, if he was a Baptist like the previous reverend or not. But he held a meeting of prayer and exorcism, it said. He asked the spirit to speak, and the response that came was loud trumpet playing. This made the Reverend flee the home, but the trumpet blasting continued to play, and the performance ended with the display of lit matches. More mayhem and mischief continued, and eventually the landlord of the Teed home, Mr. Bliss, was worried about potential damage that could happen to his cottage, and he asked Esther to leave the property. The family begrudgingly agreed, and she stayed with a Mr. Van Omberg. And after she left, the home returned to normal. And it seemed, for one last bit of mischief, this Bob spirit followed Esther into a barn and set the barn on fire. She was again, this time, actually arrested for arson and sentenced to 4 months in prison. However, appeals from people who knew her story led to her early release. And eventually, Esther went on and got married and seemed to be rid of whatever entity was berating her. So that's the Amherst haunting.
What a story to start. I don't know if I've ever heard such a violent poltergeist story like this.
Who says it's a poltergeist, Frank?
That's a good question. It strikes me as a poltergeist story because of all of the it being focused on a singular young person, objects flying around.
Fires.
The fires, like the rapping on. For a second, I thought you meant like a rapper.
Nope.
Imagine they just hear like.
Did you really?
No, you're right.
So, Frank, I'd like to address your comment about the battery thing.
Yeah, I'm very curious.
Well, I don't think there's any merit to that, really.
Really?
Like, yeah, believe it or not. Like, I mean, I guess with enough charge, yeah, anything's a battery if you try hard enough, but we're just like so resistive to electricity we wouldn't store that amount of charge.
Interesting. But
like, maybe, like, some people are more prone to the static electricity, you know?
Is that true?
Like, especially, I feel like it is.
A lot of people
if I say it and it goes on the internet, it's true.
I mean, don't people claim they're sensitive to, like, Wi-Fi?
People swear that they have family members that can't wear watches.
Yeah.
So watches just stop working.
Yeah. So it's possible maybe something like that happened and that could, you know, attribute to like the her hair was standing on end, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
So that could be one thing. As for like all of the other things, like the thunder booms, no, that does not happen.
Also, no,
you would need insane electric potential. Like, that's the only reason it makes the boom, is it's the electricity going into the air.
Also, no one ever said they saw any like bright lights or like a flash. You know, so even like if that reverence theory was like had some backing, no one said that they saw any flash of light or at any point. So just to add to the it probably is not that
mini lightning all over their body. It's a pretty cool idea, though.
Aaron, I feel like cool you superpower. Would have like, thought like that, but in a more scholarly way back then.
I mean, it's not a bad thought. Like, if I go in there and I'm like, this is weird. I don't know what else I'd make of it. Electricity is still pretty new at that point. Not everything's completely known about it. And to the more common folk, like the reverend, may not be all up to date on the science of electricity.
Right.
Seems legit. I mean, I know at the Dr. Best house, there was that one thing, that one device that had like the two Leyden jars.
Oh yeah,
that was like the cure all. Like, it could cure bad breath with electricity.
Was
or something.
Was that huge,
like,
bullet point list?
Yeah.
Of all things, it cures.
Yes. So like, there people back then didn't know a lot about electricity, so it's possible people thought that way. And you know, at the time, yeah. Could maybe make sense.
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
I think it was some sort of demon. Poltergeist just, I don't know. It seems a little odd. It seems more like a half possession almost.
Yeah. Funny you say that. I mean, in some understandings of possession, there are different levels of it. Where physical possession is the most extreme level. But the first levels are basically this. For example, there's three levels in like the Catholic understanding. I think they are vexation, obsession, and possession. And vexation are things like physical attacks on people and mainly the person. That's the center of attention. That kind of comes up here with like the swelling and the bloodshot eyes. And
but no one was ever hurt. Yes, there were the fires, but no one was ever like technically physically attacked. I guess the pillow.
That's not true. The headboard too.
True. I guess that's it. But he wasn't a family member. I don't know if Frank was saying like if it's just people centered in the home or not.
Yeah. So, I mean, these levels, usually they just talk about what's happening to the afflicted person and not as much what's happening to people around them. Mm-hmm. But it always begs the question when you hear stuff like objects are flying around, lit matches, and then even at one point you said a knife.
Yeah, a knife attacked the, I guess he was, an attempt was on him, I guess, to that actor.
But if we take a step back and there are spirits, right? If we're presupposing there are spirits that can move objects around,
right?
Sometimes fast, and they are aggressive, why don't they go further? Why don't they throw knives, and not to be graphic, but why don't they go for kills? Do you know what I mean? It almost, it seems ridiculous that you get potatoes thrown at you instead of knives at your throat, right?
Maybe I think
that's
not
a
allowed.
Huge thing. Well, yeah, I mean, that I feel like it kind of begs that.
Yeah.
It begs the question of, like, are they restricting what they can do? But isn't that... I find it funny that we don't ever, you know?
A ghost never killed someone.
Yeah, I actually have heard a few stories where ghosts are directly responsible. But, like, again, if you have stuff that can apport objects and throw them around, why don't they just... Why aren't they better at it, at killing people?
I got two things to that. Right. One, it might take a lot, like, these spirits are just energy, essentially. It may take a lot of energy to throw an object.
Fair, yeah.
Much less throw an object accurately.
Mm.
So, like, even now, like, you as a physical being, if you tried to throw a knife at someone standing across the room, there's still a decent chance you miss unless you're, like, a trained shot, you know?
That's true. That's true. Yeah, I mean, maybe they just have really limited stores of energy and...
Let me put it into perspective for you, Frank. Imagine you die on Trouble in Terrace Town in Gary's mind. And you know how you can become an object? You have to wait for the energy to go up before you can really move crazily.
For the meter?
Yeah. So it's like that.
What a great analogy.
Thanks.
But I mean, even then, though, why don't they just save it up for one? Like, they do extreme things, but it's always up to a point and not further.
I mean, Frank, that's like saying, why don't you just sleep for a month and then go run a marathon? Like, it's not how energy works. You can't just, like, stockpile it for later.
Yeah, so you're saying are you saying that these entities would be more deadly if they could, but they literally just don't have it, the capacity in them?
It's one thought I had. The other thought is, you know, maybe these things are, like, uber smart, and, like, obviously the things got progressively worse and tried to burn down the house, so, like, maybe it was just hoping to bring in a large enough crowd and then take out as many victims with an unsuspecting fire.
Wow, that got dark.
Hey, man. It's dark out.
No, that's a good
past
point.
9 p.m.
It's not just like animalistic, like, just kill. It's like, how can I make the most despair possible?
Yeah, I'm just saying.
That's interesting.
Like, especially if, like, the spirit was wronged or feels it was wronged by Esther, or, like, what the spirit thinks Esther is, then they would want revenge against everyone that Esther loves or cares about, and so try and, like, lure them in and see what you can get away with. And maybe they were trying to kill and just couldn't, and then they're like, okay, well, if I keep bringing people in and start a fire,
we didn't start the fire.
But I kind of like my first theory better because it's more lighthearted.
I like your second one.
I believe
it's clearly intelligence behind it, you know?
So the last thing I'll say on this one is a lot of stories in the book that Rosemary talks about, there's a reason given is this psychokinetic effect, where that's the kind of thing where I'm not sure if that's true in this case, where it's okay. Yes. When there's poltergeist activity, it's generally centered around a young person that's, like, going through puberty and they're experiencing all these emotions, and those emotions are having some kind of psychokinetic effect causing all this activity.
Yeah.
But Esther's 19.
Also, that's just like victim blaming. Like, you're getting chased
I don't think they don't mean it in that way. They mean it in the sense of there's this, like, other part of the human experience that we don't understand.
Yeah, like she's subconsciously causing it. She's not trying to, but
exactly.
I don't I mean, yeah, I totally get it. And I know that's a common take, but
that comes up a lot in the book.
In my mind, I refuse to admit the existence of spiritual things or entities. So therefore I need like a scientific or rational thing. So, it's made by it's like the brain. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a very interesting, I mean, it does explain, that theory does explain why it's centered on young people and right. It has a lot of explanative power. Is that the term for it? And like
explanatory
power, like in science where you're like, this model has, it explains a good chunk of stuff.
Yep. The R squared is high.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the Amherst haunting. It was definitely an interesting story when I read it through and I was like, this is good to start. And it was right at nice at the beginning, right? Cause it's A,
yeah.
When I, cause this was alphabetical. But now we're going to get a bit more lighthearted and kind of fun. Not stories, but like
after types arson. Of,
yeah, no arson. I want to talk about boggarts.
Whoa, you can't say that.
Bogarts, boggarts, however you say it.
Like the thing from Harry Potter?
Yeah, but not that, because she probably just stole the idea from other lore. So a bogart, I'm going to say boggart. It's a type of bogey, which is also just this kind of little gremlin spirit sort of thing, but it acts similar to poltergeists.
Hmm.
And they can actually apparently be helpful and sociable with some people, but typically they're very frightening and mischievous. But still, I like to think of them as like little gremlins. However, it doesn't usually reveal itself. But it makes its presence known by playing tricks on people, like pulling their sheets off their bed. So maybe certain things aren't poltergeists, they're just boggarts.
Interesting.
They can be mean and nasty, they can scratch, punch, pinch people. Starting to sound like...
Set fires?
I don't know about that. But... some have been said to even snatch and carry people away.
Permanently?
It seems so. It's like being spirited away. The boggart.
Yeah. Boggarted away?
Yeah.
Doesn't have the same ring to it, though.
No. They tend to live in houses, churchyards, fields, but they might even live in another body, like a cat or a dog. Like a boggart will like be in the body of a cat or a dog.
Like they take the shape of a cat or dog, or a cat or dog can they be live, possessed by them.
No, yeah, they it's like a possession. They live got in it, another body.
I could think of a few people's pets that are probably possessed by boggarts.
However, and the main reason I included this, because it's a pretty short one here. Apparently, you might be like, oh, well, that's fun, but it's like, I feel like I never hear of those things. So it's just like, oh, it's poltergeists. Well, they're not so common in the modern world because they're apparently afraid of cars. So the invention of the automobile scared them away, so they don't show up as much.
That's tough for them. I mean, there's nowhere they can go then.
Maybe some like remote village somewhere.
Yeah.
Is it just cars or is it like
it said
large vehicles with
it said
wheels?
Automobiles. Like, so I guess that would be any large any vehicle on wheels.
Yeah, what about cars too? Were there international spies?
I was getting more at like horse and carriage kind of
no,
thing.
It said automobiles.
Okay. So what if Henry Ford actually invented the Model T
to get rid of boggarts?
Not for transportation, but the scare away boggarts.
Maybe. I like that. However, you know, I also like brownies, who are our next little friendly creatures. And there's actually some stuff in here that I don't think we knew.
Oh.
I know. So I don't know. She also has a bunch of sources and like further reading in her book. I can also, for each of these, go back and put those in the show notes if people, or if you want, so people can look at where all this stuff is even coming
if
from.
You can remember to, if you want to take that time, that'd be great.
I mean, it's just put on soapbox.host.
That's
a
true.
A seamless interface for users.
So true.
But anyway, so I think the three of us know, but for those who don't, brownies are helpful entities who attach themselves to a family and obligingly do chores around the house and farm, typically at night while the family is asleep. And apparently, this is where we get into, I think maybe we have the wrong idea. They don't like to be offered payment for their services.
Oh.
And according to lore, the brownie was named a servant of humankind in order to ease the weight of Adam's curse and was to serve without payment.
That's new. But okay.
Other lore holds that the brownie is too carefree and proud to accept compensation.
Well, that's convenient. I mean,
yep.
Free labor.
So you mean to tell me God was like, yeah, let me create these little brownie creatures? Because I feel like I overreacted a little bit.
Maybe. However, in something we are more familiar with, you typically leave out some food or like milk or something for the brownie to enjoy, and they can do that as they wish. You're not forcing them, you're just doing it as a courtesy. But if you fail to do that, that might cause the brownie to become a little mischievous and might cause you some trouble.
Just leave a brownie out for the brownie.
Yep. It's easy as that. It's also said that if you criticize a brownie for the work that they do, they also might start causing you trouble. And when a brownie appears to someone, they look like they're small men that are about 3 feet tall, and they dress in ragged brown clothes. They have shaggy hair. You're typical. If you see like a gnome in like some English folklore, kind of, it basically looks like that.
Or Dobby.
Or yeah. Well, no, Dobby has no hair.
Yeah. Is Dobby, do you think Dobby's inspired by a mix of like,
probably
brownie and something else? Cause you know, like the household servant.
Probably
inspired by Santa's elves.
Oh, huh.
He's a house elf.
So I just wanted to throw the brownie in there because we've talked about it at different times. I love the fairy and fae stuff. It's one of my favorite things.
Me too.
So I just wanted to give that a shout out. Our next topic is charms against ghosts. If you are ever dealing with a ghost, what you might want to do. So apparently crossing oneself, so the sign of the cross, is commonly done to ward off ghosts, demons, and the evil eye, according to Rosemary Ellen Guiley.
Also, amen to that.
What?
Amen to that.
Yeah. Also, carrying or wearing gems and stones, such as, I think it's pronounced chalcedony or obsidian, are said to protect against ghosts as well.
Hmm.
And this is one thing that I if this is like true, true air quotes lore, Supernatural, the show, got it right. You place salt along a threshold and that will keep ghosts and witches away. And, you know, in the show, they use salt for a lot of things. So if that's true,
I wonder why salt. Salt comes up in all these things. It's like, what is it about salt?
Also, apparently, if you throw a pinch over your left shoulder, it brings you good luck.
Well, if you accidentally do the right shoulder, you die.
No, then the brownies become troublesome.
Oof.
Another common material, or at least just common in the three of us have heard of it, iron and silver. being effective. You might put an iron rod on a grave to present or to prevent a ghost from coming out of the ground. You'll place an iron horseshoe maybe over a doorway to prevent one from entering that building. To prevent nightmares, it's said that you can take iron nails from a tomb and hammer them into the threshold of a door. And you can put pins stuck into gateposts where corpses have passed by in funeral processions, and that will keep away evil spirits. Crucifixes are also quite common, worn by many a paranormal investigator, I'm sure, whether they are practicing Christians or not. In English lore, so I'm guessing that just means England and not like Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. Upon a person dying, you should open or you should unlock all your doors, windows, and cupboards and leave all your doors and windows open. So when the soul comes back to for any or like any final business, they can freely leave the house.
Oh, I love that idea.
And the last thing is corpses must be carried out of a house feet first. Otherwise, the ghost will return to that home. And touching a corpse will prevent one from nightmares of the ghost of that deceased person.
That's interesting. I feel like it'd be the opposite, but I guess it makes sense.
It's like a sign of respect.
Yeah.
There are some other bits in there from here, but these were the highlights that I wanted to go over.
I can't wait to own my own house so I could just stick iron rods into the doorways or put iron horseshoes on the doors. Probably get in trouble if I did that in my apartment.
Yeah, probably. Put a bunch of obsidian around. Aaron, do you have any obsidian lying around?
I don't think so. Fallon might have some, but I'm not sure. You can use it.
It's helpful.
It's true.
I love the idea that spirits will get like stuck in the cupboard.
Yeah, it's like, get open. Oh, we forgot to open the pantry. Uncle George is stuck.
Literally. Hey, I have an Uncle George.
Oh, well, open the cupboards when he dies.
We open the cupboards and we just, like a week later, you finally open like that corner cupboard and you hear like, oh, thank you. It's like,
oh,
you're like, oh shoot, he's been stuck in there.
This next one's very, very short. But it's a throwback to the yokai episode.
So it's weird.
Oh, yeah. Creepy. It's weird. Oh, yeah. The Kona Kijiji. I think I said that right. It is allegedly the spirit of a baby who was left to die in the woods.
Okay.
And Kona Kijiji. Oh, no. E? Yeah. I is E. Kona Kijiji means, quote, the crying old baby. Now you might be like, what does that mean? Why would they call it that? Well, apparently, so the Kona Kijiji lures people who are out in the woods with the sound of its crying. And when people get close, they see that the baby, who's just, again, in the woods, weirdly has the face of an old man. And it's said that if you pick up the old man baby, you will not be able to let go of it. And suddenly it becomes too heavy and crushes you.
That's horrifying.
I know. So if you hear baby crying in the woods, don't go. Leave. Get out of there.
Generally good advice.
This is an actual baby.
Screw them.
Too bad.
What are they doing in the
roll
woods?
Roll those dice? I don't know.
It's their fault.
Getting lost?
Being a Kona Kijiji?
I'm just saying if a baby finds a way into the woods, it should learn how to get out on its own. If you're a baby and you can't find your way out of the woods by age 6 months, you're on the wrong track.
Yeah, buy my course so you can learn.
Exactly.
Frank, I think if we put you in the woods right now, I don't know if you'd know how to get out.
I'd get a ride out on Bigfoot's shoulders. He'd probably be like, come with me. I will lead you out. So I wouldn't have to know.
I have a few more stories here. One, I'll save the worst one not for last. So we end on a happier note.
Oh, okay.
So we'll do that one now, actually. It's another haunting. The Smurl haunting. This is much more recent. So I'd like to bring you all to the home of Jack and Janet Smurl in West Pittston, Pennsylvania, between 1985 and 1987. The Smurl family lived in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. But after Hurricane Agnes flooded the area, they were forced to leave in 1972. Jack's parents, John and Mary, bought the house in West Pittston, which was built in 1896, in 1973 for a whopping $18,000.
That's so sad.
For you.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want this house, though, as we'll see.
Oh.
The home was a duplex, and John and Mary lived in the right half, and then Jack and Janet and their two daughters, named Dawn and Heather, lived in the left half. Jack served in the Navy and became a neuropsychiatric technician. I'm not really sure what that is.
Wow.
And both Jack and Janet were raised Catholic. They enjoyed living with Jack's parents. They thought it was great that they could do that. And the first 18 months that they lived there, everything was great. However, things started to get a little weird in January of 1974. There was like this weird stain that appeared on a new carpet. Jack's TV set burst into flames. Water pipes kept leaking even after they had been like soldered closed. A new sink and bathtub were heavily scratched, and even freshly painted woodwork showed scratches. So, kind of strange, but they didn't really think anything of it. However, in 1975, Dawn had reported that she saw, quote, people floating around her bedroom.
Oh boy. This is the daughter?
Yes.
Like a little girl?
Yeah, she's pretty young, I think, at this point. So there are people floating around her room often.
I don't like this.
Oh, it gets worse. 1977 rolls around, and the Smurl family now is like, okay, something is wrong. Something's amiss here. Toilets were flushing on their own. They were hearing footsteps when no one was walking around. Drawers were opening and closing on their own. Radios played music when they were unplugged, and there were strange smells permeating throughout the home. Jack had even felt caresses by something invisible. Couldn't see what was touching him, but something was caressing him. Also in 1977, Jack and Janet had a set of twins, Shannon and Karen. And they were starting to get really annoyed by all the stuff that was happening. Oh my God, that was terrifying. For those of you listening, Sarah just showed up behind Frank's camera and opened the door slowly. I'm just like, oh my God.
Oh my God, I just watched in my webcam the door. I mean, it's complete darkness, and oh my God. Okay.
That was funny. Anyway, now let's finally jump to 1985. And activity has really ramped up. The house was cold most of the time. John and Mary, again, who are Jack's parents, heard loud and abusive language coming from the left half of the home, even when Jack and Janet weren't arguing about anything. In February of that year, Janet had heard her name being called several times while alone in the basement. 2 days later, a black human-shaped form with no facial features appeared to Janet in the kitchen and then dematerialized through the wall and appeared to Mary on the other side of the house. A large ceiling light fixture crashed down on Shannon, almost killing her. And mind you, she's like 8.
Wow.
And this happened on the night that Heather was to be confirmed. Coincidence? Maybe. She was also 13 when she got confirmed. I guess it was different back in the 80s. You could get confirmed. I was 16.
Really?
What?
Yeah.
Didn't you get confirmed in like 8th grade?
No, that's when we started learning about confirmation and what it meant in 9th grade.
I think you're the odd one out, actually. I think it's usually 13, 14.
Yeah.
Well, it's when you're an adult in the church, and I think my church was like, let's have them at least like think a little bit for themselves.
Probably makes more sense, to be honest.
Anyway, in June of that year, Janet was pulled off of her bed, and while her and Jack had finished some business, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But so Janet gets pulled out of the bed and Jack just laid there unable to move because of this foul gagging odor. He just couldn't get out of bed because something smelled so bad. Phantom dogs ran through the home. Invisible snakes hissed at them. Bedspreads were torn apart and Shannon was tossed out of bed and down the stairs.
Oh my God.
Even neighbors heard screams and other noises coming from the home, even when the Smurls were not present. In January of 1986, who are you going to call?
Warrens.
The Warrens, yes. Ed and Lorraine Warren were called to investigate, but they apparently remained skeptical.
When the Ghostbusters are away, you have to go to the Warrens.
Yeah, true. They arrived to the Smurls home with an RN, which is registered nurse, for those who don't know, who was also a psychic. Her name was Rosemary Fruehe, F-R-U-E-H. I think it's like Fruehe? I don't know. Rosemary. Not Rosemary Ellen Guiley. But the trio interviewed the family about ways that the supernatural could have been invited into the house. Like, had they played with a Ouija board? Were they, you know, practicing any occult rituals? And obviously, they said, no, these are Catholic-raised people. They weren't doing anything like that. A bedroom closet was identified as the, quote, crossover point between the two sides of the duplex. And they said that there were 4 entities present, 3 minor entities and 1 demon.
I wonder how they determined that that was the crossover point.
I think it was Rosemary that did that. Because she's psychic. Allegedly, of course.
Naturally.
And like I said, there was no evidence of any discourse in the family. No occult practicing. So the Warrens hypothesized that the girl's transition into puberty awakened the demon who had been dormant in the home for many years. So this kind of like bridges the, oh, it's someone going through puberty. They're causing all the things. It's like, yeah, that's true. But they woke up a demon. It's not them causing it. They woke it up. So the Warrens had tried twice to get it to leave, the demon specifically. They played religious music and used prayers, but that didn't seem to help at all. And on one occasion, the demon spelled out, quote, "You filthy bastard, get out of this house." Very pleasant,
That's not nice.
No, very rude. It seemed only prayer and holy water could stop the activity, but still more went on. There were pounding and rapping sounds in the walls. Jack and Janet were slapped, bitten, and even viciously tickled.
Oh, that's insidious.
I know. Like, that's such an odd, like, form of torture, I guess. It was also apparently reported that, I guess, a content warning.
Oh.
Jack was sexually assaulted, to use a better term, by a succubus who posed as an old woman with a young body with red eyes and green gums. Janet also suffered a similar fate by an incubus, and apparently pig noises could be heard in the walls.
Oh, what?
I know. It's bad. And it doesn't, it gets a little better in the end. The Smurls tried to get help from the Diocese of Scranton, but help wasn't likely to show up, unfortunately, for them. But eventually, the Warrens brought in Father, who he eventually apparently became a bishop, Robert F. McKenna. And he refused to abide by the changes to the exorcism ritual that was mandated by Vatican II.
So he's
based.
I just looked him up. He's like almost sede vacantist, which is like,
sure,
the Pope isn't real because of Vatican II.
Oh.
He's a sede privationist, which is like not. He's not in. I don't think he's in the communion with the Pope, let's say.
Oh, no. Is he still alive? Because this book came out in 2007.
He died in 2015.
Oh, okay. So he has since moved on.
Looks like he was never excommunicated or anything, but okay. He was definitely like a old school, let's say.
So he gets involved, but the activity continues. Karen fell ill and almost died. Dawn, one of the daughters, was also almost sexually assaulted. Janet and Mary were slashed and bitten on the arm, and Father McKenna performed a second exorcism, but no luck. The entity, this demon, followed them on their camping trip to the Poconos and harassed Jack at work, so they couldn't even leave their home. They decided to appear on a local Philadelphia talk show to just try and get help, although they remained anonymous on the show. This only made things worse, though, it seems. Janet was levitated and thrown against the wall. Jack saw a monstrous creature that looked like a pig on two legs in the house. A human hand broke through the mattress of Jack and Janet and grabbed the back of Janet's neck. And Jack was sexually assaulted again. The Smurls gave a public interview, and it attracted onlookers and skeptics, as it always would if you go public with anything like this. And Paul Kurtz, who is the chairman of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, or CSICOP. It's a mouthful. But he's from Buffalo, New York, and he went to go investigate with the Warrens. However, it seemed that the CSICOP, again, that's the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal.
Wow.
It seemed they were already skeptical. And they were ultimately denied access to the home, which kind of just further ingrained in them that this was just a hoax. Kurt cites discrepancies in what Dawn had experienced in her recounting of those experiences and criticized the Warrens' involvement. He suggested that some of the experiences could be attributed to abandoned mine voids in the area that were settling and creating strange noises. Delusions by Jack that he was being assaulted by a ghost. A broken sewer pipe causing the foul smells. Or pranks by teenagers. That last one is a very, very big stretch. But to their credit, to the CSICOP, there was some more kind of odd behavior from the Warrens and the family. More so the Warrens. Of like not letting them see reported evidence, and they were still barred from entering the home. No one was allowed in the home. So it is a bit odd that the Warrens say that they had this evidence and then, oh, we can't show you.
Of course.
So that it is a little strange, but the increased press coverage made the Scranton Diocese finally act, and they sent Reverend Alphonsus Traveled of St. Bonaventure to investigate. He believed that the family was disturbed by what was going on, but he could not say whether something demonic was to blame with certainty. Two more exorcisms were conducted, and everything seemed to eventually calm down by 1989. A book and a movie, both titled The Haunted, were released in 1988 and 1991, respectively, about what happened at the Smurl home.
Wow.
I know. I'm glad I didn't save this one for last. Normally I do. Normally I save the wildest, craziest stuff for last, but I was like, this is a little, I don't want to end with this one.
Again, going after
the puberty adolescent daughters. Yeah. However,
but also not committing to it. Like, come on, commit to it. Kill him.
However, yeah, true. Almost dying, all this stuff. It seemed like Jack and Janet experienced more of the harassment and activity than their daughters. Yes, some terrible things happened to their daughters. Like Shannon almost got killed by a light fixture. Karen got really sick and almost died. Dawn was almost sexually assaulted. Heather, I guess, was fine. The only mention with Heather was the light fixture almost killing Shannon when Heather was going to be confirmed. But most of the activity, maybe they're hearing the sounds and things like that, but like the other activity, a lot of it is focused on the parents, which is odd.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if there's, did they really not do anything? Or like, you always wonder what the real full background of the people involved are,
And it is another thing that kind of jumped out to me was there was activity and some weird things happening back in the mid and late 70s. And then we just skipped to 1985. Like, between 1977 after the twins were born in 1985, it just doesn't describe anything happening. But some stuff happened before that for over the span of a few years. Maybe, and also that could just be random things. Like, and it's not, there was nothing paranormal or supernatural that happened in those previous years. And it was just whatever. But I mean, it is weird that Dawn said she saw people floating around in her room and there were drawers opening and toilets flushing on their own.
That's the weird part, Nick.
I'm talking pre-1985.
Okay.
Like, there was some weird stuff that, okay, the water pipes leaking even after being soldered. That's not like, okay, I guess. But some of the, like, a radio playing when it's unplugged, that doesn't make, that makes no sense at all. But then there's this big gap. There's an 8-year gap where nothing happens, or they don't talk about anything happening. And then all of this crazy, crazy stuff and these attacks and manifestations of things and noises all happen over just a span of, like, really 2 years. I'm not saying it's a hoax or anything like that. I'm just saying it's weird that there's a pretty sizable gap of apparently no reported activity, and then it's just bam.
Yeah.
Certainly strange. Maybe, I don't know, maybe the entity that was haunting them was waiting for an opportune time.
Yeah, I mean, the Warrens, you know, they said that, oh, their transition into puberty awakened it because it was dormant. But, like, the twins would have been, like, they would have been maybe getting towards 9. That's a little early for puberty. And Dawn and Heather were, it doesn't say how old they were, but they moved into the house in 1974. We're 12 years later. If they were, maybe they are like mid-teen years and it's them, but I don't know. Oh, I guess she was 13 in 1985, Heather was. So could be Heather, but I don't know how old Dawn is. Yeah, it's just odd that all, you know, this stuff happens. And then, oh, you can't see any of what's going on and you can't come in the house.
Yeah, the Warrens always, I mean, that's why they always were controversial.
Yeah.
But, I mean, people want scientific studies and approaches to these sorts of things that refuse to play by the rules of researchers.
Right.
Like, you're never going to get ghosts. You're never going to get a laboratory environment. Right. And be like, okay, activate the ghost in the box and let's take measurements. So it's, I feel like on purpose, there's always stuff like, oh, we had evidence and it disappeared and all that sort of stuff. But it's interesting to me when people come up with all the different possible excuses.
Yeah.
It's like, mind voids and,
yeah, I'm not too keen on what Paul Kurtz said, but I'm also a bit suspicious of the fact that you didn't even let them go in the house. And I think just based off kind of memory from the story, there was like a video or a picture of something maybe that the Warrens had. But then when Kurtz and his organization asked to see it, Ed Warren said, oh, I sent it to some like school, but I don't remember the name of it. And then, oh, it's with the church now. And then the organization reached out to the church and they're like, we don't have it. We don't know what you're talking about. And sure. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's some great conspiracy theory. And they don't want to say that we have it and it's this thing that you can't see.
Yeah.
But then you still don't let them in the house. So it is this weird mix of all this insane activity and no one, and even the other priest isn't discounting that they were, something was happening, but he couldn't say full on if it was demonic or not. And this guy, and he's sent from the diocese, maybe, and you could argue, oh, he was just told to say that if you want to, again, get conspiratorial, but it's a tough one. Because you guys were hearing all the awful things happening.
Yeah.
And then you hear, oh, these other independent people want to look. Oh, you can't look.
Yeah.
Another priest comes in. I can't say for sure something demonic is happening. And then a book and a movie get released.
Yeah, that's always like, oh, really?
So, I don't know.
That's an interesting one, man. A lot of... If only we were there. If only we could see and experience things for ourselves.
I don't want to be there.
If only we could interact with these terrible, evil things ourselves.
Frank, it would follow you. Because it knows it could really mess with you.
Oh, really? Aaron, you're the one that does boots on the ground research. You're most at risk.
That's true.
Yeah, but I don't go in and be like, ooh, I wonder if I could see a ghost and bring him up.
You don't go in with like a cabinet and you take home the cabinet and hope the spirit is stuck in it?
Yeah.
A mason jar?
I go in with scientific equipment.
Like a Luigi's Mansion ghost vacuum.
No, with like a EMF reader and a recorder.
Like the recorder, the instrument that we learned in like...
Yeah, and I play some hot cross buns and all of a sudden the ghosts start dancing out from the closet.
You see like the flower vases like dancing, lifting up.
Exactly.
That's good. For the sake of time, we'll skip over one story so we can get to our last one here about Wild Edric.
Is that a nickname?
Yes. So this story became famous in the 11th century, which is the 1000s for those who don't know. And it was during the Norman conquest of Britain. So William the Conqueror. But this story comes from, I believe it's pronounced the Domesday Book. But it's like Domesday, but I think it's pronounced Doomsday. At least that's how, I think that's how Jared Kingsley pronounces it. Shout out to you. Modern History TV. Shout out to.
Yeah, what a cool guy.
Mr. Kingsley, Sir Kingsley. I think he's knighted. Yeah,
I believe so. Yeah.
Also, I forget, is his first name Jared? I actually forgot.
I don't know.
Anyway. So according to the Domesday Book, Wild Edric was a landowner in Shropshire and Herefordshire.
Names in England.
And
you know?
I don't think it's Shire. I think it's Sure.
Sure.
Exactly. Okay. And so in the summer of 1067, Edric led an uprising against the Normans in the Welsh Marches, where he overran Herefordshire and threatened the Norman troops. They're probably like, what is this freaking guy doing? this wild man. And he and his men fought for 2 years. And in 1069, they sacked Shrewsbury in Shropshire. Oddly, though, Wild Edric ceased fighting in 1070. He was not captured nor beaten in battle. And it's uncertain why he stopped fighting with the Normans. He eventually made peace with William the Conqueror and was given honors at his court.
He switched sides?
Yeah, and in 1072, he joined the Normans in fighting the Scottish.
Wow.
Or the Scots. However, there's no record of what befell him after that. It doesn't say how he died, when he died, who he fought with, or anything like that. There's no record of what happened after that. However, according to legend, Wild Edric was out hunting in the forest of Clun and got lost, wandering around until twilight with his young page, which is kind of like a squire. The two of them eventually saw lights of a large house in the forest and went towards them. Don't go towards the lights in the forest, by the way.
Yeah.
Inside.
They didn't know back then.
Yeah, they didn't know. inside the house, they found a group of beautiful noble women dancing in a circle. But they were taller and fairer than human women and were dressed in elegant linens. They sang a song in a language that Edric and his page couldn't understand as they were dancing in their circle. And it didn't take long for Edric to become besotted with one particular woman that he saw.
Great word.
Thanks. He also don't do this. If you're like at a school dance or something, like if you're a younger listener and you got prom and you see girls dancing and you see one and you're like, wow, she's really pretty. Don't do what I'm about to say. Wild Edric, seeing this woman that he is just madly in love with, runs up to her, lifts her off her feet, and starts fighting off the other women with his page to escape.
He kidnaps her.
He kidnaps her. I just like to imagine it's like you and your boss, who you're like a blue collar worker. It's you and your boss. You're 20. He's 58. And you're like fighting, and you're just like fighting off people. And then now for 3 days, the woman did not speak at all. But on the fourth day, she warned Edric not to reproach her, which is like means kind of disrespect her, on account of her sisters, or he would lose his bride and good fortune, eventually resulting in an early death. Edric swore he would not and would always remain faithful to her. They were then married in the presence of many nobles, and even King William the Conqueror, heard news of this and wanted to meet this bride, who was known as Lady Gada, not Gaga. Gada. Maybe it's Goda, G-O-D-D-A, but I think it's Gada. Her great beauty was enough to convince King William that she was indeed a fairy bride. He wanted to see if she was this supernormal being, and her beauty alone was enough to convince him.
Oh, did he get jealous or something?
No.
That's good.
Edric and Lady Gada lived happily together. But one evening, after Edric came home from hunting, he could not find his wife. She eventually appeared, and Edric basically went sicko mode on her.
Oh.
Not physically.
Oh, okay.
Just like yelling at her and accusing her sisters of detaining her. In that instant, she vanished. And Edric immediately knew that his promise that he made was broken. I forget, there's a good word for breaking a promise, but I don't remember what it is.
Is it reneged on the
That's like a word. I don't think it's the one I'm thinking, but we'll go with he broke his promise. Yeah.
That's more like a
yeah. He broke his promise and she vanished. He searched where he first found her in the woods that fateful night, and he wailed and cried for her to come back, but there was never any response. And soon after, he kind of just wallowed and kind of deteriorated over time and died.
Damn. He had one job.
He had one job. And that's the story of Wild Edric.
He just had to bring up all her sisters.
Yep. So,
rookie mistake.
That is it for us tonight. I want to also remind everyone, all of our listeners, that this is the first episode of our October episodes. And October, we do a little different, where we release an episode every Wednesday instead of every two Wednesdays, or at least we try to do every two Wednesdays. But the month of October, it's the spookiest month. We are planning on having an episode come out every single Wednesday. So the first one, this will be October 2nd, if you're listening to it on its release. And every Wednesday after that, up until October 30th, unfortunately, we missed Halloween because of the leap year.
Unbelievable.
We will have episodes being put out. So you should be expecting 5 episodes this month, rather than the typical 2 or 3, depending on how the days fall.
Yes. I'm excited. I hope you guys are too. I think this is a great start to the spooky season, Nick.
Thank you.
Some light and dark stories.
Yeah. And I thought, you know, Encyclopedia Ghosts and Spirits, it's a good intro to the spookiest month of the year.
So, indeed it is.
Aaron, do you have anything else you'd like to close out with?
No, I just, again, great job, Nick.
Thank you.
Really interesting, and you know, you never fail to keep us on our toes. Because I don't think even if you gave us a million guesses, we would be able to guess what you just told us tonight.
I appreciate that. I do like to go off the deep end sometimes. That is all for tonight. Again, we're available on wherever you get your podcasts, and eventually we'll get our YouTube situation figured out and you can listen on there if you prefer. And also, again, check out soapbox.host if you are interested in hosting your own podcast. Also, I believe there is an email somewhere in the episode details that you can reach out to Frank and with questions and comments.
Wednesday at 9 p.m. at gmail.com, all spelled out, no numbers.
Great. References will be in the show notes. There will be a link to this book, and I'll also, depending, I'll look at some finer details and I'll see it to put the sources for that book in the show notes as well. But thank you for joining us. Have a good night, and maybe don't make a promise to a fairy bride that you meet in the woods for 5 seconds. Have a good night and enjoy the spooky stories that we have coming for the rest of the month.